It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we dig into the ethical standards for U.S. Supreme Court justices, how they compare to lower courts, and the impact they could have on our justice system. First, every piece of legislation having to do with taxation, revenue, and how money gets spent by our state government has to go through the 16-member Joint Finance Committee of the state legislature. That includes Wisconsin's two-year state budget. Democratic Governor Tony Evers introduced his third budget proposal in February. For the third time now, the Republican majority on the Joint Finance Committee started deliberations by rejecting a long list of the governor's initiatives. Last week, the committee took its first actions on the next state budget. In a 12-4 party line vote, it removed 545 of those proposals. If lawmakers and the governor don't reach a new budget agreement by July 1st, state spending would continue at levels set in the current state budget. Wisconsin is expected to end its fiscal year with a surplus of more than $7 billion. One of the four Democratic members of the powerful Joint Finance Committee joins us now. We have invitations out to Republican members as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the state budget is built? What are your priorities for spending in Wisconsin? What do you want state lawmakers to consider before agreeing to a spending plan? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. LaTanya Johnson has represented the 6th State Senate District in Milwaukee since 2017. Before that, she served in the State Assembly. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're on this Joint Finance Committee. I like the legislature at whole. There's a solid Republican majority. What do you think of your role? How do you see your role as a member of the four in that 12-4 division?
Well, basically being on Joint Finance, especially when you have numbers that low compared to my 12 Republican colleagues, basically your role is to be the voice, to use your words to try and get the message across, especially regarding the governor's budget, why that budget was important, why it's significant, and why so many people across the state had input in that budget and wanted to see things implemented.
The budget covers a lot of ground, and the 545 items removed from the governor's budget by Joint Finance last week had a lot of different elements. I want to start with gun control and gun safety measures. Your Republican colleagues removed a lot of those. Some of them, they said, because they weren't a budget item, because they were separate, guns and safety items, not part of the budget. Were you sorry to see those removed from the budget?
I was extremely sorry to see those items removed from the budget, especially being from Milwaukee, because we have so much gun violence here. You know, in warmer months, people look forward to the summers just simply because they get to shed the layers. But here in Milwaukee, we don't necessarily look forward to the summers because we know that that's going to come with an extra level of gun violence. And the items that the governor put in the budget were basically the bare minimum, the things that people agreed with, like universal background checks. We know that 79% of Wisconsin voters say that they support having background checks for the sale of firearms, the extreme risk protection order. We know that, individuals support having guns removed from individuals, especially in times of need concerning their mental health. So those were just some of the things that were removed. But other items that did have a physical impact were the sales tax exemption for gun safes and trigger locks and gun barrel locks. We know that those things are equally as important. And being able to remove the taxes from those items would kind of assure that they are affordable for everyone, especially in terms of being able to secure something as safe as a firearm.
Do you have any hope that some of those items might come up as separate pieces of legislation and have a chance at bipartisan support?
I would love to see these items come up as standalone bills. Unfortunately, that's not what we've seen in the past. When it comes to any type of movement in terms of trying to restrict or just trying to make it just a little bit more difficult for individuals who shouldn't possess guns to not be able to get them, we continue to have pushback from my Republican colleagues. the very thing that they're fighting for, the Second Amendment. For the majority of law-abiding citizens, they would have no problem passing a background check. So those individuals would not be affected. But the federal government has a very dangerous loophole when it comes to being able to purchase a gun. And basically that federal loophole allows guns to be purchased at gun shows or through online vendors without background checks. So that means that if you are a convicted felon and you're in search of a gun, you could buy one from online, from armslist.com. And they're not going to ask you if you're a convicted felon. They're not going to run a background check. They're just going to sell you the firearm. We know the majority of people are law-abiding citizens. So if there was a law in place that said all gun purchases had to go through a background check, we would see that happen. But unfortunately, that loophole allows people to get away with purchasing guns and not having to disclose the fact that they shouldn't have them.
Talking to State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, member of the state's Joint Finance Committee, about the two-year budget plan currently in the works in the state legislature. We've been talking about some firearms provisions removed by Republican leaders from Democratic Governor Tony Evers' budget. There's a lot more to it that we're going to get into. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. My comment would be, every time there's a surplus, the whole thing about giving tax refunds becomes kind of a political football. And I just kind of see it as short-term pandering that kind of sets the wealthy against the rest of us in terms of who's getting it. So I would rather see any budget surpluses be put into long-term beneficial things like energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, things that benefit the whole state instead of just becoming another political football. And thanks for your time. I appreciate you.
Jordan, thanks a lot for calling in. Senator Johnson, Governor Evers' original budget plan had some tax cuts in it. Republicans also looking for that as well. What do you think about that question about how to balance what to do with the surplus between tax relief versus investing in, as Jordan said, things like infrastructure?
I completely agree with that 100%. There are better things that we could be doing with those tax dollars that would, generate long-term gain for the state. One of the things that was pulled out of the budget that I was extremely sad to see go was the tuition promise. We all know how expensive college is right now for our young people and their families. And for that very reason, so many just smart, intelligent young minds don't get to go on to higher education. The tuition promise would have allowed children whose families made gross under $62,000 to go to college for free. Now, that didn't include room and board. That was just tuition. But the important aspect of that is that we know that we have a worker shortage right now. And we also know that those immediate fixes are not going to work. We know as a state that worker shortage is going to continually get worse, especially by 2035. So allowing these kids the opportunity to stay here at home, to go to college here at home, and to have that tuition paid means that we're going to have a more educated workforce. It's going to be better for innovation. It's going to be better for those higher paying jobs to come into the state. And it helps us keep our talent right here at home. The one thing that we know is that over these last 10 years, we have had a zero net gain in terms of immigration, meaning there have been more people leaving this state than we have had coming into this state. And that is a huge problem. We didn't start to see just a little bit of an uptick of people moving into the state until after 2020, which was around 2021. What the state doesn't know is if these individuals were moving to Wisconsin because of work, or if it was the younger people who were moving back home because of the pandemic. But either way it goes, the state cannot continue to function with our residents making a mass exodus for the border, because we will continue to see that worker shortage and it won't benefit the state at all.
Jordan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Wisconsin State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, member of the Joint Finance Committee, taking a look at the ongoing state budget deliberations, what some key proposals mean for the state and for Milwaukee in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to look at shared revenue, how state tax money flows back to local communities, what it means for communities around the state, and some special rules for what might happen in Milwaukee. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wisconsin Democratic State Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee. We're talking about her role on the powerful Joint Finance Committee, the Republican proposal to increase state funding for local governments with some strings attached, and her top priorities from Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your top priorities when it comes to the way that state receives and spends money? What do you need in your community? What are you watching most closely that you think affects your neighborhood, your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Senator Johnson, Republicans released last week a plan aimed at increasing state funding to local governments by at least 10% in every community. But there's a lot of details, subject of a whole nother conversation on the show today. In Milwaukee in particular, what do you see their proposal doing?
So the proposal for shared revenue for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County is full of a lot of uncertainty. And I'm not confident that the bill that we see now from the assembly would actually make Milwaukee whole. As a matter of fact, this bill has more poison pills from what I see than I would care to understand. For example, the Police and Fire Commission, we all know the issues that regarding untrust in terms of the police department and the community. Well, the Fire and Police Commission, it basically helps to bridge that level of trust. It gives the community a place to file grievances, to go and have their issues heard, to try and make both fire and police better. Now, there are provisions in this shared budget that calls for additional members, one fire and one police retired individual that lives within the city of Milwaukee. That's not an issue. The concern is removing the policy and oversight from the Fire and Police Commission and giving it back to the fire and police chiefs. That is a no-go. That is exactly what we were trying to move away from, which was to make the whole process more transparent. Also, the two-thirds vote in order for any new spending, new resolutions, or new ordinances. What that basically does, it threatens to put a halt to government business unless it's a two-thirds vote available. And that's not something that we're interested in. Also, no local referendums. That's a huge concern. The other piece for me, though, is that when we talk about shared revenue and making shared revenue make sense for the communities, the numbers that are involved in this process makes absolutely no sense. For example, there is a community called Popple River here in Wisconsin. Popple River has a population of 43 individuals, right? So Popple River is going from $606 in shared revenue, which is understandable that an increase was definitely needed there. But then it's going to an increase of over, it's going to an increase of over 5,000%. So it would go from $606 to $30,723. On average, that averages out to $729 per person. But you have a community or a county like Green Bay, which is in Brown County with a population of 107,000 individuals, and they only got a 10% increase, which averages out to $159 per person. The math does not make sense. And in Green Bay, you have Lambeau Field. The security that is required to cover that event, just like here in Milwaukee, when you go to a Brewers game or you go to a Bucks game, the city of Milwaukee puts that security cost. And so when you have these larger venues that contribute significantly more in terms of shared revenue, then that money should be sent back to those communities in a much similar basis. But this bill, the only thing that it has that makes sense is that the individuals who were sitting around that table making those decisions decided to give the areas that they represent more money. And that's unfair. The math does not make sense.
I want to key in on a particular item for Milwaukee. Now, some local leaders have been advocating for Milwaukee City and County to be able to raise a local sales tax there. That is included in this with, again, some strings attached, a local referendum required to raise those sale taxes and conditions, I believe, related to having to use them to pay off pension obligations. I want to give a listen to Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss speaking here to the Milwaukee Press Club on Friday.
I've seen the city's budget. And I've seen the county's budget and the bad decisions made by somebody. I'm not going to cast, I don't know every decision made by everybody, but in the past, they made a series of bad decisions that only really allow for one option. Either it's dramatic reductions in police and fire, which I think are bad for our region, or it's a tax increase. People are going to have to decide which is better.
What are your thoughts on the inclusion of a possible Milwaukee sales tax increase as it exists in this particular budget plan?
Okay, so the reality is that we are going to have to do an increased sales tax. We're going to have to do that. If we do not, Milwaukee will see insolvency on January 1st, 2025. That means that the city of Milwaukee will go bankrupt. Period. No discussion. End of topic. Now, the concern for me is that sales tax is basically secured to paying the unfunded pension obligations that we have predominantly for fire and police. That is one of the reasons that we are here, is because the fire and police pensions together make up 60% of the city's operational costs. I believe our operational cost is $721 million total. Police, $300 million, and fire is, I believe, somewhere around $157 million. So together, one is almost 40%, the other is 18%. So that's an issue. But the concern for me regarding this bill is that even with that 2% increase, it does not make the city of Milwaukee whole. It does not take away our deficit. In order for that deficit to be taken away, which will be roughly $156 million hole in 2024, we would need at least 2.1%. But the discouraging part of all of these poison pills that are in this bill is that the city will be expected to pay for audits, ongoing audits, one of which would be we would have to pay for an expenditure report. Then we would have to pay, that's annually. Then every 5 years, we would have to pay for an actuary audit, and then another audit from the Legislative Audit Bureau. There is no cost associated with those audits, so we don't know how much that's going to cost us. So that's an additional cost on top of what our deficit already is that's expected to be paid through shared revenue and this increased sales tax. The other thing is that the state wants Milwaukee Public School to hire 25 resource officers. Now, these resource officers are actual law enforcement officers. That is the requirement. But the city of Milwaukee is expected to pick up the cost for 2/3 of that cost. That's another additional cost that's being attached to our shared revenue and also to this sales tax. And there are a lot of other poison pills So with the sales tax, we have to maintain the level of fire and police that we currently have right now. So if the sales tax generates any additional revenue on top of what they already anticipate the generated revenue to be, that money then has to go toward hiring more fire and police, at least up to 1,725 police officers and I believe 218 firefighters, right? The downside to that is that there are no provisions for if the shared revenue decreases. So if we find ourselves in a recession, there is nothing to protect us from that obligation, and that's the issue. The other issue is that they want this to go to a referendum. Now, in most cases, you want the community to decide if this is okay for them or not. But in Milwaukee's case, we do not have that time. The quickest that this could go to referendum without us calling for a special election would be in the spring of 2024. Then from that election, we have to give the Department of Revenue up to 120 days to make sure that they can start collecting the tax. We are facing insolvency January 1st, 2025. That does not give us enough time to make sure that we will not hit that cutoff window. The best thing to do is to not have this go to referendum, but to allow the Common Council and the county supervisors to take that vote.
And we'll leave it there. Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
LaTanya Johnson represents the 6th State Senate District in Milwaukee. She's a Democratic member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. She joined us for a look at the two-year state budget plan. We have invites out also to Republican members of Joint Finance. Coming up, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold joins us to help explain the ethical standards in place for sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices and how they can affect the public's confidence in those courts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, state Republican lawmakers put out their proposal to update the shared revenue system here in Wisconsin. Our guest digs into the numbers and what they could mean for communities around the state, big and small. Now, ProPublica reported last month that U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepted years worth of luxury trips on super yachts and flights on private jets from Harlan Crow, a billionaire Republican donor. Justice Thomas has characterized the trips as personal hospitality from a longtime family friend and said that public disclosure was not required. ProPublica is also reporting that Crow paid for the private education of a relative of Justice Thomas and bought a home from Justice Thomas where the justice's mother still lives. Neither the trips nor the purchases had been previously disclosed. Chief Justice John Roberts declined to testify to the Senate Judiciary Committee in a hearing about ethics, citing concerns about judicial independence and the separation of government powers. Republican senators dismissed last week's Judiciary Committee hearing as a partisan attack on the court's legitimacy and conservative majority. Democratic senators argued that the lower courts and other branches of government are held to higher ethical standards than the Supreme Court. The recent revelations and political wrangling have raised some questions about ethical rules and responsibilities for the nation's top court and the effects they can have on our confidence in the judicial system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about judicial ethics? What's your response to the recent news stories about Justice Thomas and some other justices, money they've received, whether they had to disclose it or not? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Russ Feingold is a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He's president of the Progressive American Constitution Society. He's authored the book, The Constitution in Jeopardy. Senator Feingold, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. You bet.
What, compare and contrast for us, what are the differences in ethics guidelines for Supreme Court justices versus the whole rest of the federal judicial system?
Well, this is just an amazing thing in light of these revelations. The people who are on the federal courts, both at the Court of Appeals levels, as in the Seventh Circuit for Wisconsin, or district court judges who sit in Madison or Milwaukee, are part of a national ethics code that is enforced by the Judicial Conference that says, look, you have to disclose personal gifts and various things that you've received. There are rules about situations where you have to or should recuse yourself from deciding on a case. In other words, not help rule on the case because you might have a personal interest. And somehow it's evolved that the United States Supreme Court doesn't have to abide by those rules. The executive branch has rules, the Congress has rules, the lower courts have rules at the state level, the state legislators do, and the judges do, but somehow the Supreme Court is exempt. And you might say, well, that's because they're beyond reproach. But these recent revelations about Justice Thomas show just the opposite. They show a shocking lack of judgment to think that one should accept this kind of gift. And it is high time for the Supreme Court to have serious ethics rules like everybody else.
With the Justice Thomas stories in particular, one of the responses has been, and I think this was in the National Review, there's no quid for quo here, that, okay, yes, a friend of Justice Thomas gave him lucrative travel and things like that, but we can't point toward a specific instance where this particular gift resulted in any difference in how Justice Thomas behaved as a judge. So no reason for concern there would be the argument.
Well, if you were trying to criminally prosecute him for having taken a quid pro quo, that would be one thing. But that isn't what this is. This is about ethical disclosure. Members of Congress can't avoid disclosing their personal interests on the argument that you can't prove a quid pro quo. It's a requirement that you have to let the public know. It has to do with public confidence. And, you know, ProPublica reports that Justice Thomas had this financial relationship with Harlan Crow, and that there were secret payments to his wife, Jenny Thomas. We're now hearing about tuition being paid for a great nephew of his. We're also hearing about other justices potentially involving real estate deals. I mean, none of this has to do necessarily with a situation that would lead to a criminal prosecution. But what it has to do with is that the public has a right to know that the highest court in the land is disclosing their personal interests. And if anyone really believes that these kinds of extreme gifts to Justice Thomas doesn't have some influence on him, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Chief Justice Roberts declined to come before the Senate Judiciary Committee, as I mentioned, at this hearing, saying it raises concerns over the separation of powers. Who, if we want Supreme Court ethical guidelines changed, who gets to change them?
Well, the court itself should be doing the job, but it isn't. And Congress can pass a law signed by the president, either insisting that the court do it itself or create its own rules. That is not anything that is violating Congress's role. And, you know, it's interesting because I was involved in the confirmation of Justice Thomas or Judge Thomas when he was then Judge Roberts. And I asked him questions under oath, as a senator does on Judiciary Committee. And I asked him what you could do to prevent special interests from lobbying judges. And he said that he didn't think special interests should be allowed to lobby federal judges. And so he made a under oath statement to that effect. And it seems to me that it would have been perfectly appropriate for him to appear in response to this request. It was not a subpoena, to appear at the hearing to allow him to explain how the court does this work, and to allow members of Congress who have a right to legislate on this or to investigate this to ask questions. He should have done it. I suppose he didn't do it because he felt it was something that Congress shouldn't be able to do, but I think he's wrong about that. And I voted for him. I voted for him because I thought he would be an even-handed Chief Justice. In some ways he has been, but I think he's mishandling this situation by basically acting like the emperor has no clothes, that there isn't a problem, that we're not to worry about what's happening with the court. But these allegations against Justice Thomas are very serious, and they're undermining the Supreme Court's legitimacy and the rule of law, which harms all of us, not just Democrats, not just Republicans. So I think Roberts should go before the Judiciary Committee voluntarily.
Talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, its ethical guidelines, where it doesn't have ethical guidelines. Russ Feingold is with us, former member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, former senator from Wisconsin. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Russ. A big problem is people tend to vote on what they figure the standards should be. like you and I agree on some things, we agree disagree on other things, but why don't we get to some fundamental questions? Like an example would be, if you have a fetus inside a pregnant human body, is that fetus human or is it not? If it's not human, then what
Dennis,
is it?
You're bringing us to another issue. Do you have thoughts on the ethics of the Supreme Court here?
Part of it is a lot of... Russ Feingold and others would be most likely against Thomas and others because of their stance on abortion, which I'm against abortion, but I'm against Thomas and others being unethical financially.
Dennis, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. So I think, Dennis, getting to the difficulty in confirming Supreme Court justices over a political view, a political difference, like an issue like abortion, versus what he says is a fundamental ethical view, like we're talking about, Senator Feingold.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. It's very important for me to for people to realize that this question about what's happened with ethics and the lack of rules at the Supreme Court is completely distinct from the terrible things that the Supreme Court has been doing with regard to its politicizing decisions, undermining Roe v. Wade, really taking an extreme view on guns, undermining the right to vote. But this program today is not about that series of serious problems that we need to address, because the court has been politicized by essentially stealing justices from Democratic presidents. This is about something else. This is about the fact that regardless of your political party, regardless of your vote on abortion or anything else, you should have to tell the American people about special gifts and interests that you receive. It doesn't necessarily mean in all cases you can't get them, but they should and must be disclosed. That's the issue here.
Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island talking about how this kind of influence might work. Talking here about the late Justice Antonin Scalia accepting over 7 dozen, apparently undisclosed, hunting vacations.
It was systematized. Some intermediary would ask the owner of an expensive resort, often a commercial property, to extend to Scalia a personal invitation to the resort. Even where the owner was someone he'd never met, Scalia treated as personal hospitality because of the personal invitation and failed to disclose the vacations. Gun industry advocates, fossil fuel folks, and Republican political figures often tagged along. No reasonable reading of the term personal hospitality would cover this, but the Supreme Court let this go on for years.
And Senator Feingold, that idea of personal hospitality, you know, you stay over with a relative or an old friend or something like that, it's exempt from these reporting guidelines as they exist for the U.S. Supreme Court. Senator Whitehouse there suggesting that offers a potentially very big loophole.
Of course, Senator Whitehouse is completely correct. You know, under Wisconsin state legislative laws that I lived under 10 years, you couldn't even get a cup of coffee from a lobbyist or somebody like that. You couldn't go on these trips without disclosing them. Some legislators went to jail or were convicted because of personal hospitality or gifts they received from lobbyists in Wisconsin. So the idea that this kind of annual good old boy hunting trip isn't a violation of this and shouldn't be reported is on its face ridiculous. Of course it should be reported. And the American people have a right to know that their justices, not just judges, but justices of the Supreme Court, are in these kind of buddy-buddy situations that obviously have an influence on the perspective of the judge. You know, I grew up with people like Tom Fairchild and Jim Doyle, judges at the state and federal level, who clearly understood that as a judge, you have to give up certain of those things you might have had if you had stayed in law practice or in business. Being a judge is a different thing. And it's high time the Supreme Court justices and those who are not reporting this information understand that.
Talking to Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society, looking at ethics guidelines for U.S. Supreme Court justices. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Do you worry about the fairness of the courts? Do you want to see Congress step in and try to impose some kind of ethical guidelines on Supreme Court justices? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Russ Feingold. He was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're talking about the ethical standards we hold for our nation's highest court after reports of undisclosed gifts and payments to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. First off, I just wanted to say thank you for mentioning Senator Whitehouse and bringing that up. I really appreciate everything he's bringing to the table. Second of all, these Republican mega donors, whether it's Harlan Crow or I believe it's Leonard Leo, they have made their positions extremely forward. And the notion that their gifts, Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, and others on the high court doesn't have some kind of influence, I think it's just a mistake. And also, I think that having any confidence that the high court is going to do the right thing, if you will, I have very low confidence that they will at this point. I think it's shameful of the high court, and I think we, the people, definitely need to kind of make a stand here.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Senator Feingold, if people agree with Chris and want to change things, what could individual people do?
Well, he couldn't be more right. That's exactly the problem. This isn't just about individual justices not revealing information. The court itself is losing its legitimacy. The polls show an enormous drop in the public's view of the United States Supreme Court, and that's very dangerous for our system. The idea in the past was that the court was supposed to be the least dangerous branch, because Congress had the sword or the purse and the president had the sword, and they just had to have public credibility to support their ability to rule on congressional issues, whether they're constitutional or not. So it is crucial that the court be legitimate. So I think the next step here, I don't think there's any justification for flailing around, but the next step is to call Justice Thomas before the Judiciary Committee. If he comes voluntarily, which is extremely unlikely, fine. If not, he needs to be subpoenaed in order to be questioned and to let him explain his view of what he did and for there to be an investigation. So before people start talking about whether he should resign or whether he should be impeached or all the things that could happen, the first thing is to find out his perspective and to have members of the Senate to have the right to question him about it. That needs to be done. They already held a hearing generally on the subject, which is good. So this should be a step-by-step thing. One thing we can't do, though, is to just let this go, because this is undermining the credibility of the highest court in the land.
Thanks for that call, Chris. Wendy joins us now in Duluth. Wendy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I have to kind of chuckle. To me, this seems like just basic common sense. But I'm reminded as I'm driving here about, I was a vendor, an outside vendor for a company that's owned by the wealthiest man in the state of Wisconsin. And we as vendors could not so much as buy a cup of coffee or a lunch for anyone within that company because it was seen as, you know, lobbying or pandering, right, or buying off, and it was not allowed. Now, that happens to be a conservative company. Everybody in business knows that this is not ethical. And so, really, this isn't politics. This is common sense, and we have come so far from common sense in this country that it's just sad.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Senator Feingold.
Said it perfectly. It's just common sense. It's just a no-brainer, obviously. The justice should not be able to take a private plane for a vacation in Indonesia or go on a huge yacht trip without telling the American people that they're doing it. And yeah, you're talking about a Wisconsin tradition that I was always proud of. I actually brought it to Washington, a gift ban for members of Congress. They used to be able to get all kinds of stuff until McCain and I shut that down. And I'm pleased to hear that, and I think it is, followed in the private sector often as well. There is no excuse for this to be the system for our Supreme Court. And it is just common sense.
Thanks for that call, Wendy. Jed joins us now in La Couture Reserve. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
My main issue is it just seems like people aren't following their own rules, or there's different sets of rules, and it makes it really confusing for the average citizen or any official. I think about the metal detectors in Washington that some people, they set them up and they just slide by, or I think about, you know, And perhaps it occurs to me that it's just capitalism showing its true face, that it's just sheer nepotism, cronyism, and hypocrisy. And I'm not for any of those things, but if they come to light and people realize essentially that's what the systems are based on.
I gotcha, Jed. Thanks for the call. Senator Feingold, Jed says he's concerned about different sets of rules for different people. I mean, is it as simple as establishing, hey, the same rules that apply to all the other federal judges should apply to the Supreme Court justices?
Well, that would go a really long way. I mean, I think there was a thought over time that the Supreme Court would never get involved in this kind of thing, that they would have the dignity to know better, but that's not where we're at. So we need to get these rules in place, either by the Supreme Court or by the Congress. And keep in mind, if there were some decision with regard to Justice Thomas, it wouldn't be the first time. President Johnson appointed a Democrat appointee, Justice Fortas, somebody who was already on the Supreme Court, to be the Chief Justice. And it would have been the first Democrat appointed Chief Justice in my lifetime. And he didn't get through because there were some ethical questions raised about his relationship with the foundation. And he not only had to resign from, he didn't become Chief Justice, he also had to resign from the Supreme Court. So this isn't partisan. It's been done on the Democratic side. It could be done on the Republican side. It's about simply having some rules in place. And as the caller said, having people not think they could have two different sets of rules.
Thanks for that call. Janet joins us now in Lone Rock. Janet, hello.
Hello. Thank you. Most of what I wanted to say has already been said, but I would like to just say that I think one of the reasons that there isn't more public outcry for this is because of the lack of civics in school. And so many people don't even understand what the three branches of government are or what the rules are supposed to be. But absolutely, the Supreme Court judges should be the stellar example of a judge's behavior rather than the lowest bar where all of our county and state, you know, judges have to follow rules that they don't have to. And I think there definitely should be an investigation in Congress and both the judge and his wife. And then let's keep going and let's do term limits and put some other guidelines on these justices, because this is just totally, totally unacceptable. And it should, and everybody should be taken to the streets over this. It's ridiculous.
Janet, thanks for the call. Senator Feingold, Janet's case that, you know, maybe we've lost a certain element of our civic understanding and not grasping the implications here. What do you think?
Well, amen to that. There's no question about it. People need to be taught at an early age that the role of the Supreme Court is to be independent and not political. And the problem now is the court has become so political and so politicized and such an agenda that if you combine that with ethical concerns and violations, what you have is an institution that loses its justification to exist. And so it is time for an investigation. It is time for action. And it is necessary, apparently, for Congress to step in a situation where you wish it didn't have to. I also agree with the caller, and American Constitution Society endorses either adding justices to the court to balance what's happened, or, as she said, term limits. We think it's time that it would make sense to have some kind of limitation, maybe 18 years for the time a justice can serve on the court. It's not working the way it's done right now.
Thanks for that call, Senator Feingold. And just our last half a minute, Republicans, including on the Judiciary Committee, say the politicization is these attacks, these overblown attacks, they would say, on the justices. Give us 30 seconds to respond to that.
Well, that's just ridiculous. Some of the investigations that have come out are talk about justices who have been appointed by people on both sides of the aisle. And I think that the members of the Judiciary Committee know very well that if they tried to pull this, if they tried to take these kind of yacht trips and not report it on their ethics forms, they'd be in big trouble before the Senate Ethics Committee, and they might be expelled from the Senate. So the idea that it's just politics when it's the same thing that could throw them out of the Senate is silly.
Senator Feingold, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society. He served on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and he joined us today for a look at the ethical standards in place for justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, are you flooded with junk mail? Get some advice on how to stop the flow of unwanted ads in your mailbox, and maybe call in and share your least favorites. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. When you think about the great villains of literature and fantasy, you probably don't think about butterflies. But now there's a direct connection between one of the evilest characters in fantasy fiction and cool-looking but mostly harmless butterflies. As reported in the New York Times science section, researchers have named a new genus of butterflies after Sauron, the ultimate bad guy in the Lord of the Rings books and movies. What's the connection? Are the butterflies launching an evil scheme to capture the Ring of Power, then send their minions on a war of conquest? No, at least not as far as we know. But they do have these circles on their wings that look a little bit like the Eye of Sauron, as depicted in art and on film. There are two species in this genus so far, more expected to be discovered. The butterflies aren't the first scientific tribute to Sauron. There's a dinosaur, a dung beetle, and a frog, plus a faraway galaxy named after him. Having a species named after you? Welcome to the club, Sauron. I'm Rob Ferret.